Thank you. You're welcome, Lissa. So we welcome, I believe, our information is the Totino Grace High School Mock Trial Team, so it's good to see you. I coach a high school mock trial team myself, so I'm very aware of your reputation. It looks like neither one of us made it to the state tournament this year, though. So that's clearly the coach's fault. And we also welcome the pages. Our next case is A23-0994, State of Minnesota versus Kurt Craven. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, and the respondent will have 15 minutes in rebuttal, and then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So with that, whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and just please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Leah Graff and I represent the appellant Kurt Craven. Craven was denied his constitutional right to counsel when the district court erroneously determined that he waived this right by his conduct. The district court's waiver by conduct determination was error for two reasons. First, the court failed to ensure that Craven was adequately advised of the consequences of proceeding without counsel, such that his subsequent conduct could be deemed a knowing and intelligent waiver. This shortcoming alone requires reversal. Second, the district court erred in finding waiver by conduct because Craven made documented and reasonable efforts to secure new counsel in the mere 11 weeks that he had to act following the court's initial warning that he may lose the right. The district court concluded that Craven engaged in dilatory tactics and pointed to prior continuances of the trial, but only one such delay was attributable to Craven. Furthermore, the district court was wrong to equate failure to meet the court's deadline with a dilatory tactic. I want to begin by talking about the waiver by conduct analysis itself. It refers to the relinquishment of the right to counsel based on the combination of two concepts. One is waiver and the other is forfeiture. The combination of those principles here require consideration of two things. Whether Craven was warned of the dangers of self-representation, and whether, knowing what he stood to lose, he voluntarily engaged in dilatory conduct. Beginning with the first question, whether Craven was warned of the dangers of self-representation, the record is clear that he was not adequately advised of the consequences of going forward without counsel.
Ms. Graff, one of the things that really stood out to me when I read through the transcript of the, you know, the warnings that Mr. Craven was given was the fact that the majority of that waiver process was actually conducted by the prosecutor in the case. I've never seen anything like that. You know, typically it's the judge who is advising a defendant of those important rights, the judge being a neutral party as opposed to, you know, an arm of the government. What's your comment or response to that?
Yes, I think that that is a unique part of this record, and it does add to the inadequacy of the advisory because the case law is very clear that it is the district court's responsibility to ensure the adequacy of the advisory. And so in that respect, not only was the substance that was reached during that exchange insufficient, but the court essentially abdicated its role to the prosecutor here. So we think it merely adds to the argument here that there wasn't a proper advisory. And the court did almost nothing to ensure that Craven was informed thoroughly, as the case law and as the rule says, of all facts and circumstances necessary to a broad understanding of the right. But, you know, even sort of attributing the prosecutor's colloquy to the court at its direction, which for the reasons Your Honor has identified is perhaps problematic, but even doing that, you know, the state doesn't disagree with the fact that he was not advised of any possible punishments with respect to the fleeing count. He was not advised with respect to any mandatory minimum sentence on the DWI count. These were all permissive consecutive offenses. That was not adequately explained. And, you know, again, getting back to this, all facts essential to a broad understanding of the consequences of the waiver, this court's case law is very clear that this means the defendant needs to understand what the expectation is of him moving forward, what his obligations will be. And we have a form that explains this to defendants that the court can utilize, whether they're signing the written form or whether there's an on-record discussion. There was no attempt made to complete the written form. There was clearly no attempt to utilize the written form. If the court had, it would have advised Craven of things that came up way, and by the court's own rulings, too late in the proceedings, such as standby counsel or expert funding. He would have known of those things at the outset, and that's the kind of advisory that would have allowed him to make a decision with eyes wide open in terms of what was relevant to him in the case.
I have a question about what the record shows regarding Mr. Craven's custody situation. There was a lot of discussion at, I think it was the December, the status hearing about his release date from prison and when the trial should start. Maybe it was at the November hearing. When the trial should start, should he have a little gap between mm-hmm. his release on intensive supervised release and the start of the trial? Does the record show when he was actually released from prison?
There's no documentation, but the record is very clear that his release date was January 24th, which was the second date of the scheduled trial. January 23rd was the Monday that they conducted voir dire and pretrial motions.
So was he in custody for that part of the trial?
He was in custody because what happened was the first morning of trial, when he was physically in the county jail but under the DOC's purview as well, the state made a bail motion. And so the court actually increased his bail the morning of trial in anticipation of his release the following day from DOC custody. So he never left custody at all. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, this idea that he wanted to get out to see his daughter and this shows dilatory motive just doesn't hold up on this record. Number one, the district court doesn't refer to his desire to see his daughter when making a finding of dilatory conduct or addressing the issue of waiver by conduct. It just, the court doesn't say anything about it. And number two is, it didn't have any practical, whether he received a continuance to get more time to hire a private lawyer didn't actually dictate his custody status, both because he was going to get out of DOC custody and the court had the authority and did exercise that authority to increase the bail, which resulted in his continued confinement anyway. He would have presumably stayed in custody even if granted some additional time, because that's what happened here.
But he would have been in custody in the local jail, presumably, rather than back at a Department of Corrections facility.
True, right. That would have been the case.
Ms. Graff, this case seems to be kind of, as all cases are, sort of somewhere between Jones and Walford. It seems like this doesn't have, like, the, you know, lengthy time that, you know, I think drove the Supreme Court crazy in Jones. But then it also seems to have more, although not in writing, of the Rule 504 discussion in terms of nature of the charges, when in Walford there were any. So what are we to make? Where do you think this case is on that kind of continuum? And why is it obviously, you know, on more the Jones continuum than others?
So in terms of the behavior of the defendant in Jones, I think this case is actually quite far away from Jones. Jones, the court says, is forfeiture. Not only is the time period, as Your Honor referenced, much, much greater in Jones, but the number of continuances Jones received solely for the purpose of securing counsel was, I believe, 3. Here we have 1. Also, the record in Jones is that he is out of custody, he is employed, he has retained counsel on another matter, and when that comes to light and he shows up for trial without a lawyer, the court in Jones still gave him an additional continuance. So I just think that the circumstances here where we have an incarcerated individual who's granted 1 continuance, and you know, the court doesn't even act or schedule a hearing, frankly, for 4 weeks once that continuance is granted, which delays the time in which he's told, hey, here's the consequences of what's going on in your case and your decision to fire private counsel. So I think we have a really different setting than Jones. And then in terms of Walford, I would say, you know, Walford is sort of an extreme example of the lack of advisory, but, you know, some advice is not enough. It's not constitutionally sufficient. Jones says that before somebody can be deemed to have waived by conduct, they must be warned in a way that meets the requirement of the rule. That didn't happen here. At bottom, respondent agrees that there wasn't an advisory in compliance with the rule, and I think that that by itself, you know, we're talking about a fundamental right. There's no presumption against it. The presumption is that a defendant who is facing felony prosecution, who says, I want a lawyer, gets a lawyer. So unless there's something that happens in compliance with the rule and the law, that's the status quo. So that's why we think.
If we agree with you that we don't think the conduct is enough here for waiver, do we still have to deal with, you know, the first part, well, was there a waiver at all under Rule 5.04, or could we just say, well, you know, this isn't enough, have a nice day?
I think you can say this isn't enough to be dilatory conduct, have a nice day. Both are required under Jones, and that's very clear. So whether this court just decides one part or the other is sufficient to require reversal and remand for a new trial. And, you know, I know that there's been, you know, some discussion about in the case with respect to the, you know, this idea that the court says, I told you to get a lawyer, you're here for trial, you don't have a lawyer. And I want to emphasize the idea that not meeting a deadline is not the same as dilatory conduct. And that's essentially what the district court does here. I mean, even when the district court grants his request to fire his lawyer, the court says, you get a one-time continuance, everybody's got to be ready for trial. Well, that can't be the constitutional analysis. The constitutional question isn't you waive your right to counsel if you don't meet the court's deadline. The defendant has to, as Jones says, voluntarily engage in misconduct. And the district court doesn't really talk about his conduct at all. You know, at the November hearing, the court schedules this December status conference and tells him, come back to that conference with a lawyer or with a detailed summary of everything you've done to get one. And what does Mr. Craven do? He does the second thing. He files a motion with the court. He says, I'd like another continuance. Here are my mail logs. I tried to get my call logs. The DOC didn't get them to me. Here are the letters I sent and that were returned to me. Here's the one opportunity I have. I would like more time. So, you know, really at that point, the court says, well, you know, she sort of questions the timing initially, but then notes that there are more recent letters sent and says, well, notwithstanding that, I told you needed to have a lawyer, so that's it.
Well, there was also this quality of, and you should get a public defender, and you should get a public defender, and you should get a public defender at every appearance. And I'm just wondering what your comment is on that strategy.
You know, I think that it was, I don't think that it answers the question here, and that's for a couple of reasons. So, you know, and the district court sort of says, well, you've been in custody a long time, so I would find that you qualify. Well, that's not the actual statutory analysis for public defender eligibility. The mere fact of his incarceration doesn't mean he is necessarily entitled to a public defender. It's a broad financial question.
Well, doesn't the district court, in the context of doing an IFP analysis, determine that he is not even, the district court, I believe, says you're not, you wouldn't have been eligible for a public defender.
Yes. The district court says at the outset of the prosecution, for purposes of the expert funding statute, you were not indigent when this prosecution commenced. And then the court actually goes on, and this is after it said, I'd appoint a public defender because you've been incarcerated, but then this is January 20th, so the Friday before the trial says, you weren't indigent at the start, and I know you've been serving a prison sentence, but I don't have any information, you know, sort of references bank accounts and other assets since you've been in custody. So the court is inconsistent at best on that issue. And I think also it's important to keep in mind that this isn't a case where you have a defendant who is saying, I want to hire private counsel, when the record doesn't reveal anything, any evidence that that is a possibility. But here, Mr. Craven was never represented by the public defender's office. He hired private counsel from the inception of the litigation. He posted a significant, it was a $50,000 unconditional bond during the proceedings. He described to the court his business that he owned, and at the November hearing said, I think I have these business assets that I can sell to try to hire an attorney. Obviously, he was trying to figure this all out from the Department of Corrections, which posed some difficulties for him moving forward, again, which he notified the court of. I think that that's diligence, and I think the court's sort of pushing the public defender solution, again, it doesn't really answer the question. The question isn't whether he could have applied for the public defender or whether he was eligible. The question is, did he engage in dilatory tactics? And we just don't think the record supports that here. I see that my time is up, so I will return on rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Graff.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court. My name is Jacob Campion. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota here on behalf of the respondent. I'm going to start with the dilatory conduct. I think there's three facts that make this case not just dilatory, but extreme enough for forfeiture. One, he admitted on the record multiple times that he wanted to delay the trial so he could get out of prison and see his daughter. Two, he was given plenty of time to find an attorney, and in the forfeiture context, I think you run it from the September 28th date, almost 4 months to find an attorney. And he did find an attorney. From the November 8th date, it took him 8 days to find an attorney who would take his case, and he said he had enough money to pay that attorney. And
he also said that the attorney required $15,000 up front just to have a meeting with him.
He said, I have reviewed your case, and I'm willing to take this case to trial, and my fee to your case through trial is $15,000. And he had said at a previous hearing, I can raise $15,000 to $20,000, whatever it takes. Seeing your daughter, that's not a bad thing. Wanting to find an attorney at your price point, that's not a bad thing, but it's not something that the judicial branch has to accommodate at every turn. And it's certainly not a justification to go speeding down I-94 drunk from Sauk Center to St. Cloud with no tires most of the way, endangering the public. So he did have an attorney available to him, and he refused. The court also said, I will approve an application for a public defender. And he didn't take up the court on that offer either. And again, it's back to him admitting that I'm trying to delay this trial so I can get out of prison. That is dilatory conduct, and it's extreme. And it is very similar to Jones. Jones was admittedly longer, but you have the same conduct. You have a defendant saying, I want to hire private counsel. But then every time they show up to court, they just haven't done it. And I think Jones says, like, you're just not following through on the last step.
Well, except, again, I guess I'd push back. He did come to court with, or he filed a log of his efforts to obtain counsel. So I think in that regard, it is quite different from Jones, isn't it?
No, because the effort showed he obtained an attorney who was willing to take his case, and he refused to hire him. So he refuses a private attorney who's available. He refuses a public defender who's offered to him. And his only explanation is that he's trying to delay the trial to get out of prison. That's dilatory conduct. That is intentionally trying to delay the proceedings for a basis that's just not relevant to how courts schedule trials.
Do we have any case law where we've said it's dilatory conduct to ask for one continuance in this context? Because I think that you, in reading your brief, I think you agree that the most of the other continuances that happened were not the fault of the appellant.
No, they weren't. We're not relying on the previous continuances.
So what's your best case for this amount of time is dilatory conduct, or this number of continuances actually attributable to the appellant is dilatory conduct. What's your best case for that?
So the best case is Clem, which was cited favorably in Jones. There it's less than 30 days, and all the court said was we're having the trial in less than 30 days. You need to show up ready to go for trial, and your attorney's going to need to be prepared. So that means you need to find an attorney in the next few days. So that's all that happened in Clem, and the Supreme Court cited that favorably to say that this is an example of forfeiture. And then on the continuous piece, I don't think it's enough to just say there was one continuance. I think you also have to note how long it was. It was one lengthy continuance for almost 4 months. That is plenty of time to find an attorney. And if he found the one he found it in 8 days. In fact, he mailed the letter to him on the 14th, and he responded, he had a letter back on the 16th. So that's 2 days. And so if he didn't like that attorney and wanted to look for one with a lower cost, he could have. He had plenty of time to do that.
Or wanted to find an attorney who would meet with him first before he had to post. I mean, right, there is a little bit of a difference here in terms of this attorney that, like, this attorney wasn't even willing to have an initial meeting with appellant until he gave him the $15,000.
And that's fine, but there's still plenty of time to find another one. At that point, it's still the middle of November, and the trial's not till the end of January. There's still plenty of time. And the record, he brings what he did to the December hearing, but there's no record that he did anything after that. And he still, in December, he still had over a month, and there's no record that he made any attempt between the December date and the January date. And I think that's why the trial court is surprised, because the last time the trial court saw him was December 19th, and he's saying, I want a private attorney. He had one. He's offered a public defender. And then he shows up on January 20th saying, I don't have one, and I want standby counsel. And so I think that's why some of that stuff happened so late, because the judge was told over a month ago that he wanted private counsel. He was going to try to do it, and there was plenty of time to do that.
Mr. Campion, in our most recent pronouncement on sort of, you know, waiver of counsel in Gant, we sort of made great, one of the factors we talked about was the failure to appoint standby counsel, which was not done in this case. So what are we to make of that? I mean, you know, from a practical standpoint, I think that's often just good insurance. Because, you know, you always hope sometime during the trial you'll turn to the standby counsel and say, how would you like to be my real counsel? Because these things aren't going well. So I guess I'm at a loss to understand the rationale for not even appointing a standby counsel. What are we to make of that, Mr. Campion?
It's not entirely clear to me the rationale either, but the
anger?
Well, I don't think there's a sufficient record to declare any misconduct on the part of the trial judge or retaliation, but
I would never imply any.
First, on the waiver piece, before you even get to standby counsel, that's kind of one of the facts and circumstances you look to when there's a failure under the rule. So before you even get to that, you'd have to declare that there was a failure under the rule, and I don't think there was. I think they went through that in the November 19th hearing sufficiently to meet the requirements of the rule. But if you do go to facts and circumstances, which we've argued is entirely appropriate, and even, you know, there are examples where the court, the appellant's arguing that you can't do that. And the Supreme Court rejected that in Rhodes in footnote 7. It's rejected in Gant. So it's absolutely appropriate to go to facts and circumstances if the rule isn't met. So finally, to standby counsel, I think it is a factor to consider, but I don't think it outweighs everything else here. And some of the other facts and circumstances that are here is that he was represented for 22 months by private counsel, and that was also during plea negotiations. So if the rule waiver was defective in any way, it would be on the range of sentences, but that was presumably covered by his private counsel that he had for 22 months.
I do have a question on the applicability of that law in the context of this case, where it does seem that his counsel was not showing up at hearings and was sending other counsel and maybe didn't actually have time for this case. How do we apply that case law regarding prior representation when there are some indications in the record that maybe appellant wasn't getting the best representation?
Yeah, and they did send counsel, so there was no, it wasn't a situation where counsel didn't show up to the hearing. He wasn't available, so he sent an associate. But the part I'm referring to where they're discussing plea negotiations, that is the lead counsel. Okay. That's a prior hearing where the prosecutor's saying, here's what my offer is. The lead counsel says, that we've discussed this.
Okay.
And that he's not doing that. And so the other facts and circumstances here are the extensive criminal history of the defendant, and not just a criminal history, but specific to the charges that were here, DWI and fleeing. He had a number of felonies, and that's another factor that the courts have said demonstrate that you made this decision with eyes wide open.
But he didn't make the decision. I mean, I think that's what I'm really struggling with here. He did not make the decision to proceed without counsel. He was told that he was going to have to proceed without counsel, right? Because he hadn't hired one.
Yeah, and that's what the waiver of conduct bucket is for. It's for defendants who don't want to proceed pro se, but their conduct is giving the trial court no other choice.
Why does his criminal history matter at all when we're looking at whether he waived by conduct?
So it's to whether he engaged in conduct knowing what he stood to lose. Did he know what it would be like to go to trial without counsel? And so you have his criminal history where he's been charged and convicted of these offenses before. He made a reference in the record that he has gone pro se before. And so it's in a situation where the rule didn't sufficiently advise him, and so you're looking to other contexts to see, is this person, engaging in dilatory tactics, knowing that it's going to result in him going pro se and what that means for him. And I think this record shows that.
I have another question. So in response to a question that Judge Larson asked for a case, you said that the best case on point was the Clem case, where a defendant was given 30 days to come up with a lawyer. I just want to clarify. I looked up that case. That's not a Minnesota case, right? That's a habeas case that the Third Circuit decided involving a Pennsylvania defendant. Is that right?
That is right, Your Honor.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we were talking about the same case.
We are. And the reason I cite it, though, is because in Jones, the court cites it not for its procedural nuance that habeas brings, but says this is an example of forfeiture, and then decides to adopt it itself, and then says Jones. And I think Jones is factually similar here, too. It is a longer time, but again, the time here was sufficient for the task to find a private counsel. And the conduct in Jones is very similar. It's just a defendant repeatedly telling a trial court judge, I want private counsel, I'll just give me more time. And then every time he shows up to court, he doesn't have it. And then the trial judge has to move things along. There's a public interest in efficient judicial system and the ability to schedule trials. And wanting to get out of prison is not a justification. Some of the earlier continuances, witnesses not available, lawyers not available, understandable. But I want to get out of prison before we go to trial in this case. That's not a sufficient reason and shows the dilatory conduct here.
I feel like you've said both things. So during your argument, do you agree that this advisory was not in compliance with the rule?
No, we're not conceding that, Your Honor. I think it was sufficient through the November the November hearing.
So you do dispute that this advisory complied, that it fully complied despite the things appellant points out that were not given during the advisory.
Yeah, I think it's because sentencing is so much flexibility. I think it's reasonable what they did was to go through the presumptive sentence for the top count. And so I think that is reasonable under the circumstances, but if this court isn't satisfied in the alternative, you can look to other facts and circumstances that demonstrate a knowing waiver, and there's where you come in the criminal history, the previous representation by counsel, the self-help guide that was provided to him, things like that.
Even though it looks like all the things that are discussed under Rule 5.04 kind of weren't touched upon. I mean, you would agree with that.
Well, they were. No, I don't agree with that. So the rule 5.04, you talk about the nature of the offenses.
Okay, what did it? Well, I'll let you go. Thank you. I was going to try to point out the one that I don't think you did go, but you go tell me.
Okay, so the nature of the charges, that's page 14 of the November transcript. The offenses, page 14 and page 19. The range, page 14 to 17 and 19, and then the range is discussed at other hearings frequently. The defenses is on page 18. The mitigating factors is on 17 and 18, and then the consequences are on page 18 and 19.
What about the conditional release issues?
I'm sorry, can you clarify?
It's my understanding from Ms. Graff that not all the points were raised. So what about the ones that she's talking about that weren't raised?
I think their best argument is on the range of possible sentences. So what they did is they discussed what the presumptive sentence was for the top charge. And I think that is reasonable given how much flexibility there is in sentencing. But, you know, they have an argument that, well, this was a permissive consecutive situation, and there was also a mandatory minimum that affects downward departures.
Did the prosecutor go through the range on both charges?
No, just the top count.
What about the fact that it was the prosecutor going through the waiver and not the district court, the entity that's supposed to go through the waiver? What's your response to my concern about that?
Yeah, I think if the substance is there, it shouldn't matter. And it was on the record. One of the cases cited in the briefs had a situation where there was an off-the-record discussion with the prosecutor, and that was something the court had a concern about because we don't know what was said, but the concern wasn't that it was the prosecutor advising them. So I think if the substance is there, it just shouldn't matter.
It could be anybody off the street or
someone who's allowed to participate in the proceedings.
Okay.
As long as it's clear that the defendant is making the decision with eyes wide open, I don't think it should matter, prosecutor or court.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Campion.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You're welcome. Ms. Graff, you'll have the last word, please. And before you begin, and I must have missed this because I've been so focused, would you mind taking off your hat, sir, please? Thank you. Please go ahead, Ms. Graff. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. So I want to start with one thing that is sort of a theme of respondents' argument, which is that Mr. Craven was asking for a continuance of this trial so he could get out of custody. That is simply not consistent with the record.
Well,
he didn't get out of custody.
I don't think it's a good plan either.
No, and he didn't get out of custody without
so it didn't work.
Either way, for the reasons that we've talked about in terms of the various factors controlling his custody status that the district court exercised here on the state's motion. And when we look at the transcript of the December hearing where he's filed his motion to continuance and the court says, let's start with your request for continuance of the trial in the county matter, which is this case, and he says, yes, ma'am, I guess I would like to request a continuance to allow me adequate time to properly seek legal counsel with better resources and no time, resources, or restraints due to my 23-hour lockdown in this facility. That's what he says. The district court, again, no part of the district court's analysis of his waiver by conduct has anything to do with him wanting to get home to see his daughter. He talks about his daughter at various points in the proceeding. I think it's just a human response rather than anything else. And I also want to get at the idea that he was given almost 4 months and that he can't just keep asking for continuances to sort of like accommodate his request at every turn. I think context is so important here in terms of figuring out what is dilatory. The amount of time that Mr. Craven was granted on his sole continuance request to obtain a new lawyer to effectuate his constitutional right was shorter than the time the state was granted when one of its witnesses was on vacation. So this isn't a case where the case has, like Jones, been dragging on and on and on and on and on for a year because the defendant keeps showing up and saying, I want a lawyer. We're talking about 11 weeks between the time he was told, here's what the implications are of your decision to fire your private attorney, and here's what is going to happen moving forward. So this just is not Jones. I think Clem is...
So Ms. Graff, what are we looking at? Are we looking at just the period from September to January? Do we look at that, or do you want us to just look at it from, October, November to when he was told, okay, we're going to have one more continuance, get a lawyer? Should we be focusing on that, or I've got a pretty good idea of what Mr. Campion wants us to focus on, but what do you want us to focus on?
So at most, I would say the court could look from the October discharge of his private lawyer to the January trial, but because there was a delay in getting him into court in the first instance to conduct any sort of colloquy through any party with him to any degree, what respondent's argument, especially when we're talking about a broader facts and circumstances analysis about whether the waiver was knowing, it starts to degrade the very necessary component of waiver by conduct, which is there is a sequential issue. Waiver that is affirmative waiver, like in Rhodes, is the defendant is saying, I don't want a lawyer. I want to proceed pro se. That is very different from somebody who is essentially, this is a waiver by implication. You knew what you had to lose, and Jones talks about it. In the face of that knowledge, you engage in misconduct. So you can't sort of look at the broader nebulous of facts and circumstances that unfold, including he gets a pro se guidebook the night before the Friday, you know, of his Monday trial to say, oh, then he acted in a dilatory way in December because in January they told him what the consequences were. That doesn't work in waiver by conduct. So, and in...
What if the court had waited another month and said, all right, you know, one more time, we're now going to start in February. And he came back and said, you know, the only lawyers who will come help me want a retainer, and I can't, and I don't have the money for a retainer. Would the court be justified in saying, tough?
I mean, I think it would depend on the factual circumstances that develop. I think it would
these
be facts, closer.
These facts, a month later, he says, they all want a retainer, and I can't get a retainer.
Is he in custody or out of custody?
He's in
your
custody.
Hypothetical? Okay.
He's in custody. And
I think then you get closer to some kind of dilatory conduct. But again, it is less about, in this case, we just don't have those facts. We don't have this ongoing problem like in Jones, either for purposes of forfeiture or waiver by conduct.
Thank you very much, Ms. Graff. Thank you very much, Mr. Campion. We appreciate the diligence and zealousness with which you argued the case. We will issue our decision in 90 days. So I imagine you all want to leave now, so we'll stop for a second so you can file on back before we do the next case. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're quite welcome.